From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The suspect in the recent stabbing incident in Muncie, New York, who injured five people at a rabbi's home, has been charged with federal hate crimes. 37-year-old Grafton Thomas's web searches included references to Hitler and Nazi culture. He also apparently searched for the phrases, "Why did Hitler hate the Jews?" and "German Jewish temples near me." Like the suspects in the earlier Jersey City shooting at a kosher grocery store, the suspect may have been linked to a controversial group called the Black Hebrew Israelites. There has been a notable uptick in anti-Semitic incidents around the country at the same time as a growing crackdown on free speech supporting Palestinian rights. In an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times, my guest Phyllis Bennis wrote, "I'm Jewish, I fight anti-Semitism, and I support Palestinian rights." Phyllis Bennis is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's written a number of books, including Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terrorism, as well as Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan. She now joins me to discuss this op-ed she wrote. Welcome to the program, Phyllis.
Great to be with you, Sonali.
So first, it's just kind of horrifying to see this uptick in attacks, especially during the holidays. And I suppose Orthodox Jews in particular are a visible target because they are so visibly Orthodox Jewish. It's sort of like Sikhs who wear turbans or Muslim women wearing the hijab. They become vulnerable in particular to racists, right?
Absolutely. There's a clear correlation between white supremacy and racism and the kind of violent anti-Semitism that we're seeing on the rise. And of course, you're right that Orthodox Jews are particularly vulnerable because they stand out, the kind of clothes they wear, the way they appear, and because their tradition requires a level of closeness because they're not allowed to use transportation to drive a car, for instance, on the Sabbath. So they cluster in communities where there tends to be larger groups, so they're more identifiable. And in the recent past, that seems to have made them more vulnerable.
So I want to talk about
It is important to see this in the context of the rise of white supremacy around the country.
Yeah, and so I want to talk first about the latest two incidents that have actually been linked to black suspects linked in this group, the Black Hebrew Israelites, but then broaden the conversation to the optics and anti-Semitism in general. These last two incidents in particular suggest that maybe it's not so cut and dry, that there is some nuance and complication when we talk about anti-Semitism, right? Who are the Black Hebrew Israelites? There are some well-known people. The rapper Kendrick Lamar identifies with this organization.
I'm not an expert in the organization. My sense of having seen them around in New York for many years is that they have a fairly wide range of politics. It seems that there is at least alleged to be a kind of violent component to it that is explicitly anti-Semitic. It's based on a theological claim about Jewish, white Jews in particular, I think, are targeted as being false Jews, and that the real Israelites, the real inheritors of biblical identity, are black. Now, I don't think it's necessarily something held by a large number of people. As you say, this is particular to the allegations of the two recent events. It's important that we recognize these are not clear convictions or anything like that. These are allegations of connections to something called the Black Hebrew Israelites, and it may be nothing more than a link to a website. We don't actually know if there was any kind of connection, and if so, what kind of connection. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that the overall rise in violent anti-Semitism that we've been seeing over the last several years, that included the horrific attack in Pittsburgh, where the Tree of Life synagogue was targeted and 11 worshipers there were killed, with the allegation that the shooter was claiming that the Jews, particularly this synagogue, were responsible for what Trump has identified as the evil of immigration coming to the United States because they supported the resettlement of refugees. in the synagogue outside of San Diego. Similarly, it was a white supremacist who is alleged to have carried out this attack that killed one and injured more. So we're seeing that kind of violence in its attacks. We saw it in Charlottesville, where the call of the Nazis and the Klan, who were marching in their Unite the Right protest 2 years ago, had the chant, "Jews will not replace us." And they were the ones who were then identified by President Trump as including very fine people. There were very fine people among them. And so when you see that kind of enabling of white supremacy from the very heart of the US government, from the White House, from the president, then we have to look very carefully at how this rise of white supremacy and within it an anti-Semitic component that goes alongside the anti-Black component, the anti-immigrant xenophobic component, the anti-Muslim component, all of these things are then linked.
And we also saw just a few weeks ago, President Trump giving a speech to a pro-Israel group where he engaged in some of the most, awful anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic stereotypes and tropes, right?
Particularly long-standing tropes that have to do with the idea that all Jews are wealthy. He said in one of those meetings with Jewish Republicans, these are presumably his supporters, he says, "I don't like you, you're not very nice people, but you're gonna have to vote for me anyway because the Democrats want to tax the millionaires." So there was this assumption that every Jew in the room, every Jew in the country perhaps, he believes, is somehow rich, which is a long-standing false, of course, Jewish trope. In another incident, he was again meeting with wealthy Republican Jews who are longstanding contributors to the Republican Party and to his campaign. And he was talking at one point about his decision to recognize the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights as a legitimate piece of land now under Israeli control, as it should be, something like that. And he said, "I was standing with your prime minister when I made that announcement."
Right.
And here he's talking to a room full of U.S. citizens. The Israeli prime minister is not their prime minister. He is their president, whether they voted for him or not. But the notion that because they are Jewish, that Bibi Netanyahu is somehow their prime minister. And then he went even further in that same meeting, looked at Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, the very wealthy casino owners who have been the largest funders of Trump's campaign and among the largest funders of settlement activity inside Israel and the occupied territories. He looked directly at them and said, when he was talking about the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, he looked at them and said, "Sheldon and Miriam, I did it for you." So here he is saying, "I made this momentous, horrific decision at the request of my funders," something that he claimed falsely that Representative Ilhan Omar had said. She didn't say that, but she was accused of being an anti-Semite for having supposedly said that. He actually said it, and no one in that audience stood up and said, "Excuse me, Mr. President, aren't you making some bad assumptions here?" Nothing like that.
This president, this particular president has really promoted an interesting paradox here in the United States, where under the watch of President Trump, U.S.-Israel relations are stronger than ever. He has made it very clear to Benjamin Netanyahu that the U.S. will basically tolerate anything Israel does, whether or not it affects Palestinians. And at the same time, here in the U.S., he has tamped down on Palestinian rights. All of that while he has some very, very high-level folks in his cabinet. His own son-in-law is Jewish American. So he has Jewish Americans within his own family. He's embraced Israel, and he's given a signal to white supremacists and directly engaged in anti-Semitic tropes himself. This is just very, I guess, Trumpian is the only word for it.
It is, although I would say he's hardly the first to have this disparity between being anti-Semitic in terms of anti-Jew, anti-Jewish, etc.
Which one would hope is the actual direct definition of that term, anti-Semitic.
Exactly. And at the same time, supporting Israel, supporting Zionism as a political movement. If you look at, for example, the central leaders of the Christian Zionist movement, who tend to be right-wing, fundamentalist, evangelical Christians, their theological reason for supporting Israel and supporting Zionism as a project, the notion of the, quote, ingathering of Jews into Israel, is based on a thoroughly anti-Semitic theology that says that the reason we want to support Israel and support the movement of Jews into Israel is because before the second coming can happen, before Christ can return, all the Jews have to be in Israel, in that part of the world. And when they do, then we can have the second coming and all the Jews will have the choice to either convert or die.
Wow.
And I gotta say, as a Jew, that's not exactly a great choice to have, you know, that you either convert or die. But that is the basis of the theology for Christian fundamentalism and Christian Zionism. And again, it has that weird contradiction built into it that's thoroughly anti-Semitic and yet is the greatest level of support for Israel. In fact, if you ask Israeli officials or ordinary Israelis, so what do you think about getting all this great political support from these people who say that you should have the choice to either convert or die? The answer is usually a sort of shrug, and it's like, oh, come on, we know that that's all nonsense. Mm. We don't believe any of that. But we will take the support from wherever we get it.
Wow.
So it's a built-in contradiction, for sure.
So pro-Israel, but anti-Jewish.
Exactly.
Let's talk about how the pro-Israel push has also, of course, translated into a very severe crackdown on the First Amendment right of Americans who want to speak up about Palestinians. This is a story we've been covering on our show for a long time with the attacks on the BDS movement, especially on campuses, pro-Palestinian groups, and Trump's, of course, recent executive order equating Jewish with being an ethnic group, being part of an ethnic group, precisely to crack down on campus activism around Palestine and Palestinian rights. We had talked to a young activist from Jewish Voice for Peace about this issue, but you wrote about it in your op-ed in the LA Times. So lay out your argument for us. How do you explain this to someone who just, you know, takes for granted that anti-Israel bias is equivalent to, or anti-Israel sentiments are equivalent to anti-Semitism?
Well, I think there's two issues that are underway here. One is this notion that criticizing Israel is somehow anti-Semitic. You know, sometimes supporters of Israel accuse critics of Israel of holding Israel to a different standard. And they say, well, you should hold Israel to the same standards as every other country. The reality is they are the ones that are holding Israel to a different standard. We can, and we do, criticize all kinds of countries for all kinds of human rights violations. I don't know if any of those folks have been out at the protests at the Saudi embassy, for instance, for the massive violations of human rights that Saudi Arabia routinely commits. But that's a longstanding movement to condemn U.S. support for Saudi Arabia because of its human rights violations. In the case of Israel, the notion is that if you criticize Israel, you are somehow criticizing Jews, and therefore it's anti-Semitic because you're therefore anti-Jewish, because Israel claims to be the state of the Jewish people. Now, this is particularly tricky because in the last year, Israel has passed a law, what they call part of their basic law, which is essentially equivalent to a new piece of the Constitution. If we had a new constitutional move in the U.S. to amend the U.S. Constitution, it would be the equivalent of that. It's not just a law, it's a very big deal law. And that law is called the nation-state law, and it says that only Jews have the right of self-determination in Israel, despite the fact that 20% of Israeli citizens are not Jewish. They're Palestinians, they're Christian, they're Muslim, they're whatever they are, but they're not Jews. And so it explicitly says that those 20% of citizens have no rights no rights in the country that the rest are bound to accept. That isn't even talking about the Palestinians who live under Israeli military occupation. We're just talking about the citizens of Israel who are not Jewish. So once they pass that law, they're saying that we speak in the name of Jews. They claim to speak for me because I happen to be Jewish. They are not my country. That is not my government. They do not speak for me. And yet, they make the claim that they do, and they have popularized that claim so that people believe if you criticize Israel, you're criticizing Jews. If you condemn Israel, you're condemning Jews. It's those of us, whether we're Jewish or not, who make the distinction between the state of Israel and its government and Jews around the world. We're the ones who are saying, no, no, you know, Jews around the world are not responsible for what Israel does in their name. So that's the distinction that gets lost here. The other side of it is, the irony, of course, is that the Civil Rights Act, Article 6 of the Civil Rights Act, which talks about discrimination based on race, color, or national origin, it explicitly does not include religion. So that the widespread and rising attacks on Muslims, for instance, is not protected officially under Article 6 of the Civil Rights Act. Attacks on Catholics is not included here. None of those. And in practice, Jews have been protected when there is clear attacks on the rights of Jews as Jews. It has been investigated by the Justice Department over years. I talked to people in the Department of Education who say that it's understood that even though Jews are not officially a race or a color or a national origin, it is sometimes used as the basis for investigating anti-Semitic attacks. So it's not as if there hasn't been a way to actually protect Jewish students or other Jews from anti-Semitism. This is different. This is saying, number one, that the definition of national origin includes Jewishness. And I wanted to say in my op-ed that, I'm sorry, Jared, you might be Jewish yourself, but you don't get to say
right
whether Jews are suddenly defined as national origin. My ancestors didn't come from what is now Israel, what used to be Palestine and what is now Israel. They came from Eastern Europe. They had been in Eastern Europe for as long as anybody can ever remember. So this notion that it's somehow only white Jews, that's the assumption, and that they're all somehow part of the same national origin. What does that say about Ethiopian Jews? What does that say about Chinese Jews? What does that say about the numerous Jews who are Arabs, who come from Iraq or from Morocco, or who are Iranian or are Turkish, or who came from Moorish Spain? All of these people are just as Jewish as the white Eastern European Jews like me, who some people seem to think are the only ones out there. There are black Jews, there are brown Jews and yellow Jews. So the notion that Jews are all one race or one color or one national origin is simply a racist erasure of the fact that there are Jews of all races and all colors.
Phyllis, in response to your op-ed in the LA Times, one reader of the LA Times, Jonathan Jacoby from Sherman Oaks, wrote that your op-ed promoted a conflation that lumped together Israeli annexationists with progressive Zionists who actively support Palestinian rights. He writes that you correctly defended the right to boycott, but did not address any catastrophic impacts on Israel were the boycotters to succeed. I suppose he's writing that there are progressive Zionists who support Palestinian rights, but oppose BDS. I know this might be sort of nitpicking, but what do you make of this critique?
Well, there's no doubt that there are people who oppose Israel's occupation of the West Bank, for instance, and oppose BDS, who are against the boycott movement. But it's important to recognize that the boycott movement was a call in 2005 from 170 Palestinian civil society organizations. It didn't come from any government. It didn't come from the Palestinian Authority or from anybody else. It came from trade unions and the women's associations and the youth groups, all the professional associations. My personal favorite is the Palestinian Dentists Union. We're a founding member of the BDS campaign. Wow. Calling on people around the world to engage in efforts at boycotts and divestment campaigns and sanctions efforts with a very specific aim, to pressure Israel using nonviolent methods here, to pressure Israel to end three kinds of international violations of human rights and international law. It's not, we're going to boycott Israel forever because we don't like Israel. It's very specific. So when the writer of that letter indicates what would happen if the boycott succeeded, what would happen when the boycott succeeded is that it would end. The boycott would succeed when Israel stops its violations, its occupation of the 67 territories, its denial of the right of return of Palestinian refugees, and its refusal to allow Palestinian citizens of Israel to have equal rights. When those three violations end, the boycott is over. So when the writer says, what would happen? What would be the catastrophic result if the boycott should succeed? My answer is, the boycott would be over. That would be pretty great.
And so a lot of this, these attacks on First Amendment rights are based on ignorance about what BDS is, just as what anti-Semitism is based on, ignorance, right? Real anti-Semitism, yes. Anti-Jewish racism is in the Absolutely. End based on ignorance.
It is, and it's unfortunate that it's so rooted in the history of racism in this country. Yeah. You know, if you look back at modern anti-Semitism, which you can trace back to around the lynching of Leo Frank in 1915 by the Klan. That was the rise of the new sort of modern anti-Semitism. It's been now 100 years of that legacy where it's linked to the anti-racism, the anti-black racism of the Klan and other violent organizations like that. There was a lynching of a white man, a Jew in Tennessee in 1868, right after the Civil War, at the beginning of Reconstruction. That was from an earlier period. And then that period kind of ended, the Klan reemerged, the modern Klan took on anti-Semitism as much as it did anti-black racism in this country. And all of it was linked to white supremacy. When you saw those Klan members and Nazis in marching in Charlottesville in 2 years ago, when they were chanting, Jews will not replace us, it was linked to this so-called replacement theory, which is this right-wing white supremacist theory that is based on whipping up fear and ignorance among some white people in the United States, as well as in Europe and elsewhere, that says that people of color, and it can be different in different places. It might be Muslims in one place. It might be black people in other places. It might be Jews. People of color are somehow going to take over the white majority of whatever country we're talking about and are going to replace them. So there's this vicious chant, Jews will not replace us, meaning we will remain in power. We will remain the dominant force. And those Jews will not be allowed to be equal to that. That's really the essence of what that chant is all about.
Well, Phyllis, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to your op-ed from our website. Thanks, as always, for all the work you do.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also a prolific author, and we've been discussing her new op-ed in the LA Times called I'm Jewish, I Fight Anti-Semitism, and I Support Palestinian Rights. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.